So of course, I'd like to start by saying to thanking the organizers for inviting me and giving you a warning about my talk, because I mean this is likely going to be the only talk primarily focused on the numerical effort, and as such, I thought that perhaps the best thing I could do is to try to give some representation of where the field is at the moment and where contact with the mathematical community could really help a lot. And so I'm going to be talking about some of the stuff I've done and some of the stuff colleagues have done, hopefully with the aim of trying to showcase the good things we can do and the ugly things we're doing, and where you could probably help us. So the overview is, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the basic efforts that are out there. What is it that we know and what is it that we'd like to know at the continuum level that could really make an impact in our work? Just to illustrate that whatever work you do to help us, we can actually try to take advantage of. I'll show you just one transparency of how we can go from the continuum estimates that you might have to discrete estimates, and how some of the things that we've learned are actually making headways or giving important messages to other disciplines. I'll show you the status of some simulations, and mainly I'll pick three different examples, though depending on the time I might jump one completely, but these are simulations in three dimensions, two dimensions, and one dimension plus time, just to show you how when we don't have that big of a problem with the resolutions, we actually can make quite a strong impact as far as the physics we can extract from our simulations. And so I'm going to talk about astrophysical black hole simulations. That's going to be the 3+1 part of the talk. And the other ones, I'm going to make contact with some higher dimensional black holes and related systems. So if we were to say where we are now, well, there is a good, a bad, and an ugly answer to that. The good, as you'll see in a few transparencies, we've advanced quite a bit on the development, analysis, and use of different formulations of Isons equations. If you were to go 10 years to the past and you saw the equations we were using back then, we would probably say now we were a bunch of fools. Well, maybe you'll still say that today about a few of us. But back then, we were using formulations that were weakly hyperbolic. And then you consulted a standard textbook, and I would say, well, if you have lower order terms, generically, the problem that you treat is going to be ill-posed. Well, regardless of that, that is what the system as a whole was using. Those were the ADM equations. But by now, we all know those are bad equations to try to implement numerically. And there has been quite a bit of effort in trying to come up with equations that would have much nicer properties. And by that, I mean strongly or symmetric hyperbolic formulations. In order to do that, well, you can write many, many formulations of Isons equations that have such kind of properties. But basically, in order to obtain those kind of formulations, you have to make a judicious choice of gauge. And likely, you'll have to add the constraints to in a suitable manner to the evolution equations. Once you do that, you can write these formulations with better stability, with better analytical properties. But you still have quite a bit of freedom. So if you are thinking that, well, you've written your system as a first order in time, first order in space system of equations, say this is what you have from Einstein's equations, and you can add somehow this schematically these constraints in this way with some free parameters. And then when you do the analysis of the hyperbolicity of the underlying system, then it turns out that you still have plenty of freedom in these parameters to and still maintain a symmetric hyperbolic type formulation. You put that into a computer, of course, all these formulations would be completely equivalent at the analytical level because you simply added zero to the right-hand side of your equations. But when you put that into a computer, they can behave completely different. This is an example of exactly the same code in three dimensions, choosing these parameters in some particular way. And in one case, you can evolve, say, this is a black hole space-time, but the detail doesn't really matter. You can in this unit of time, you can evolve for 30 with a relatively good resolution. You simply change the value of these parameters, and all of a sudden you can go to about 1,000. And again, the only thing you change is the value of those parameters. So the poor man's way of dealing with this, and that's what we do in our community, is, well, some people do a parameter search. They tried a bunch of different simulations with a bunch of randomly chosen parameters. To make it a bit extreme, And then you choose the ones that work the best for your particular simulation. That is, of course, not what you'd like to do. There, we have other efforts that dynamically adjust the parameters. As you are evolving, you choose the parameters that make the simulation look the best, and you keep going. But that is has some question marks of, as far as not maybe you're probably breaking some of the nice properties that you worked at the continuum level. So this has some question marks associated to them. And then there are some efforts that try to use some techniques similar to the ones used in the magnetohydrodynamics field, which try to clean up the constraints. Every now and then you see how bad your constraints are, and you try to modify the solution in a slight manner so that the constraints are projected onto the constraint hypersurface. But all this, in a way, is pretty much ad hoc. If we don't know of a really fundamental way to either choose a particular formulation that will drop the constraints to zero, or that will a priori give us some estimate of how, having chosen a given formulation, things are expected to behave. I'll make contact with this again later on. If you put that problem aside, and you say, well, let's assume that for a moment this is not our worst nightmare, you can quote a different type of problem, which is the one that relates to the boundaries. When you analyze the equations, usually you tend to ignore the boundaries, but at the numerical level, boundaries are there and you have to deal with them somehow. As a result, we have to deal with the initial boundary value problem of general relativity, and today there is a single formulation of the equations, or a single way to write the problem that is known to be well posed, and that is the one introduced by Helmut Friedrich and Gabriel Nagy just a few years ago. I'll try to say why is it that is this problem is tough. So suppose that you have written your equations and you're trying to obtain the solutions within this cylinder here. These are the boundaries of your computational domain. So if you only look at the initial value problem, you know that, well, assuming you've written the equations in a suitable manner, you can estimate that the solution is going to be, the problem within this cone is going to be well posed. But you would like to solve Einstein's equations everywhere. So the first thing you can do, and that we do routinely, is to analyze evolution equations. Given a particular boundary, we analyze which modes are incoming with respect to that boundary, and that is just a simple algebraic problem as to understand which are the eigenvalues, the positive eigenvalues with respect to the principal part of your equations. And then that tells you which are the only allowed modes that you could define as boundary conditions. But of course, knows nothing about the constraints. If you don't realize how the constraints are propagating, you might be giving boundary conditions to these modes, say, that are incoming, which will violate the constraints. So this is the second step in the construction. Then what you do there is you look at the evolution of the constraints, this subsidiary system induced by the evolution equations themselves. You find where there are eigenvalues there that are positive, which then means that there are some modes, constraint modes, that are coming from the outside. And you try to define a relation that will keep those modes to zero, and what does that imply to the main evolution, to the main variables, and that tells you what is it that you can put here. The situation nowadays is that for a subclass of systems, and at the linear level, we more or less know how to do this, assuming the type of boundary condition you put here is such that you set to zero everything that is incoming up to these constraints, up to the information that the constraints are telling you. Unfortunately, that doesn't give you enough physical freedom, because what you would really like to do is to set up conditions, boundary conditions there, that imply that there is no incoming radiation. If you try to impose the no incoming radiation condition and try to make contact with the psi zero, one of the Newman-Penrose quantities, then it turns out that the conditions that you end up obtaining there give you a weakened instability in your code, and things actually blow up in your face. Friedrichs and Nagy, by appropriately modifying the equations at the fundamental level, at the expression level, they're able to guarantee that there are no constraints coming in from the outside of the computational domain to the inside, and therefore this problem is simplified quite a bit at the cost of having to write a formulation that is in some sense, highly non-standard, and therefore there is very little experience on that, and this has to be gained, and there are there is a project at the Albert Einstein Institute of people are trying to gain the experience needed to actually try to push forward this formulation. But of course, I mean, in the back of your mind, you think, well, there shouldn't be a very special formulation where you could do this. There should be more, and you like to write more than one code so that you can compare answers that these codes are providing. If you try to analyze a problem in a model problem, and this might be interesting for some of the mathematicians in the audience to try to get their hands into this problem, there is a model problem that Sarbach and Reuler presented very recently, which comes from the Maxwell's equations. And there, at the end of the day, the message is, if you want to guarantee that no incoming modes are going to come in that do not violate the constraints and conform to the physical situation that you have in mind, which is no incoming modes, no radiation incoming from the outside, and all radiation that comes that hits this boundary leaves, in order to prove well-postness, they need to specify a gauge condition which is elliptic in nature. And so far in the community, we have stayed away of elliptic hyperbolic problems, but it's pointing to the fact that if you want to use a formulation that is more like like the ones used in the standard approaches, we might not be able to get away from an elliptic hyperbolic problem. But this is a question mark nowadays in the field. If you are worrying about the global null problem, by that I mean reach null infinity and try to understand what the field's behavior is there, there are two approaches. One is matching to a characteristic formulation or the conformal equations, and we'll hear more about this, I think, in the next talk. But I'm not going to talk about this. So I said that there are ways that we know of that, given something known at the at the analytical level, we can exploit that at the numerical level. And just in a simple transparency, I'll tell you what this boils down to. Again, if you have a first order in space equation, and we're going to assume for a moment that we have non-constant coefficients, but they do not depend on u, so it's a linear equation. If you prove well-posing of the system through the energy method, then you end up with an estimate that looks like that. So you define an energy with an appropriate symmetrizer, and look at the rate of change of that, and you bound it this way. And in order to get this sort of estimate, something that plays a crucial role is the fact that iteration by parts hold. So what we do at the numerical level is actually write down our derivative operators such that the analogous at the discrete level to the iteration by parts is satisfied. Once you do that, it gives you control about a semi-discrete energy estimate. It tells you also how to control the boundary terms in such a way that the energy doesn't grow in a spurious manner. And it also tells you that if you want to add some dissipation to control some high frequency modes that are being badly modeled anyways, how to do so that you don't spoil the estimate. And then there are standard theorems in the applied mathematics community that says, well, you do that with an appropriate time iterator, and basically continuum stability implies discrete stability. So the only message I want to bring home here is that if there are concrete mathematically oriented results, we can, with some work perhaps, actually translate into useful numerical recipes. Let me get to the first example, just to show you how the combination of, well, perhaps some of the best things we know from the analytical arena, combined with a lot of ingenuity at the numerical side, you can actually put together a simulation, say, that contains two black holes and try to get some feeling of what the physics involved is in the system. So here I'm going to describe primarily Franz Pretorius' effort. This is someone who got his PhD in Vancouver, then went to Caltech for about 3 years, worked mainly isolated there because the rest of the community didn't pay too much attention to him, and all of a sudden came out with binary black holes collision. And I'll tell you some of the main things that he's done there. The first step he took basically was to ignore what everyone else was doing and write equations pretty much as Yvonne showed 50 years ago. In harmonic coherence. He thus chose harmonic coherence. At least there you are guaranteed that the system is going to be one with good properties. Again, by that I mean symmetric or strongly hyperbolic. He chose the generalized harmonic functions. By that I mean this condition, rather being serious, is given by some source functions that he's going to use, and he's going to exploit so that some things that you need to do at the numerical level are satisfied. The constraints in his language now become just simple simply the harmonic coronary condition, and something that does play a major role in the binary black hole simulations that he has is that on top of the evolution equations that you have at the harmonic coronary, when you use harmonic coronaries, you add to the right-hand side or to the equations this kind of term, which again at the analytical level should be zero because it's just a bunch of constraints, but at discrete level can make a huge difference. So the question here is what happens if you start with some non-trivial violation of the constraint in your initial hypersurface, how will the system behave? Carsten Gundlach is the one that suggested France to use these kind of terms following some earlier work by these people. And Carsten and his group in Southampton shows that if you analyze these on perturbations of Minkowski, you can actually show that the constraints are going to be damp as you perform the evolution. So there is an example of some initial violation of the constraint will bring you that back to the constraint hypersurface and of the solutions if you apply these terms in an appropriate manner and you choose this constant suitably. Let me show you an example of what Franz has done. Here on the left, you'll see what happens with the evolution. Again, exactly the same evolution. Here, these terms are not going to be added. Here, the terms will be added. And what he's showing here is the constraint violation. So he's evaluating the constraints over a three-dimensional computational grid, making a set equal zero cut, so it's just an arbitrary cut, and we'll see what happens. The initial data, by the way, is just Schwarzschild with some perturbation. So after a while, the left became black because it basically crashed horribly, while the right one keeps going. And it's these terms that make the whole difference. So it seems that the stability properties of this system are much better than those without this, and this is what Carsten showed, at least for Minkowski. So they are showing up in the Schwarzschild case. Unfortunately, it's not robust for all problems. He does the same thing, but instead of putting a black hole there, he puts a boson star, so it's just a self-gravitating scalar field configuration that should stay there for quite a while. Either you add or you don't add, those terms don't make quite a big of difference. Of course, intertwining all this are the numerical errors that you're building up here. And so it'd be good to be able to detach what happens at the numeric or the extra garbage that you come in at the numerical level with some fundamental understanding of the equations how is it that they behave with this kind of terms added on. What are the status and prospects of what he's doing? So at the moment, he's not really caring about good initial data, even though in the US, there is this huge pressure about giving waveforms for LIGO. Given that any of these simulations takes about 3 months in effective terms, he says, well, let's just try to build some parameter search, pick up some arbitrary initial data that does show that have two black holes, and let's see if there is any robust features in the waveforms that perhaps the people from the data analysis community can use. So the main thing I wanted to say here is the two numerical tricks that he applies here is one is an adaptive mesh refinement technique, which basically allows him to have a much better resolution where the stuff is actually going on without basically running out of memory in the supercomputer he's using. And he used this that in the mind of a mathematician can be horrible because it's complexification of spatial coordinates. His equations go all the way to infinity, but you know that things are going horribly there. The equations go singular. But what happens in practical terms is he's going to add some dissipations, and whatever gets close to space like infinity is going to be completely killed by dissipation, as you'll see in the movie that I'm about to show. So let me first show you some of the dynamics that he sees in the code. So here is just a plot of a particular component of the metric. So this is just a lapse. You'll see two black holes that are going to do about an orbit, and then they're going to merge. The interesting thing is that he is able to get some numbers, even though there are errors associated to them. And he's able to measure, say, the ADM mass of the black holes initially, of the spacetime initially, and he calculates the final mass of the black hole some time after the merger. And he compares this with that one, and then you would say, assuming the errors are under control, the system has radiated about 5% of the mass, which is a lot. I mean, the ballpark estimate that people had before was about 1%. And so this will, if true, if fully confirmed by further simulations, this can be very important for LIGO. And let me show you what a typical evolution is. You'll see two holes showing up in the movie, and those are the holes that are there so as to excise the singularity. The singularity is cut from the computational domain, otherwise things just go to hell. And what you do there is you put an inflow boundary condition, and I'll have some questions at the end about that. So this is what you see. So you have these two guys are going around each other. They finally merge into a single one, and things just apparently stay quite well behaved afterwards. Let me show you this now, this effect of the compactification of coordinates. If you look at very close to where the black holes are, then you just see these two blobs, and the way he's creating initial data is there, he's just putting two scalar field configurations that are super critical. So if you let them go a little bit, they collapse and form a black hole. He does so as to have a much easier time with the initial data problem. So here things look okay. So you have these two little holes going around each other, again, merging and forming a single one. But this projector is going weird, so I have to go back and forth. This is what happens when you see the full grid. And you'll see this structure coming out. And as it gets close to the borders, because there is a compactification in each coordinate, basically even by these equations, you'll see a very square-like structure simply reflecting the grid-like the grid that he's using. But you'll see how this amplitude that is supposed to be constant just goes to zero as it gets out. And that's mainly due to the dissipation in the code. So as they go out, then this thing basically just gets completely killed. So that's the way you avoid, even though the equations at this border are singular, that nothing ever gets there because it's completely killed beforehand. So that is what I said before, a combination of some good analytical properties using a system that is known to be symmetric hyperbolic, which has explicitly wave-like nature in it, with some if you want, numerical ingenuity. He has some nice plots about what is it that you obtain if you were to go to a common a center of mass coordinates, how would this orbit would look. And so this is not at the center of mass, so this is what the trajectory of one of the black holes is, and this is the other one. And with respect to a center of mass coordinate, this is more or less what it looks. And what he's trying to look for is here an idea of what eccentricity of the orbit of the binary system is. And it's claiming that it has to be in between 0.2 and 0.0 by simply plotting the different eccentricities for an orbit that starts here. And so because it's in between 0 and 0.2, and then this thing just merged due to radiation reaction, hopefully, not their numerical errors, then the claim is that the eccentricity is at most 0.2 for that given orbit. Of course, the main thrust of these efforts for binary black holes is to obtain the waveforms. And so let me just show you what he does for that. And this calculates the quantity psi 4, this Newman-Penrose quantity. And so initially, you have a lot of garbage coming in because the initial data is not good enough. But later times, you just have what you expect, a nice quadrupole that is right in a way. So things, qualitatively speaking, look OK. This is another cut now at a given angle of how things work, how things look. I think there is quite a bit of garbage initially, but then by extracting the radiation at different radii, he sees a reasonable agreement in the obtained waveforms. Let me just give you a summary of what he does. So he has a base grid resolution that is very coarse, just 33 Q points to cover from minus infinity to infinity, but he has 9 levels of refinement. So the effective resolution is about as far as the minimum distance between points is like if you had used 9,000 points in the whole grid. He does like 50,000 time steps from the final level to reach to the final time. This takes about 550 hours combined on 48 nodes running continuously. But what happens is in reality is nodes go down, the machine crashes for hardware reason, etc. So something that would be 20 days ends up being 3 months. And these are some numbers. So he needs about 10 gigabytes of memory, and he dumps quite a bit of data, even though he's doing it very infrequently. Just to give you an idea of how expensive these simulations can be. This is what I said about the adaptive mesh refinement. This is just a picture of the coarse grid. Then there is an R grid inside of this. There is an R1, and there are 9 levels in total, so that when you get to the hole, you are actually refining it quite a bit. So without this kind of infrastructure, you couldn't even hope to model these things in a reasonable way. Something interesting, but he's putting lots of caveats about this, is that now that he got some initial data, he can try to tune the parameters so as to have more than one orbit. So by choosing these initial boost parameters that he gives this initial data, he can try to see what happens if he does it right so that these things hang around each other quite longer. And unfortunately, he's unable to do so. Either the holes merge very quickly, or there is kind of a zoom weird thing. These guys go around each other for a while, and then these black holes fly apart. Let me just show you a typical example there. And here it's similar to before. These two guys get closer, but at some point they don't like each other, and they just fly away. So if this were true, this would be very, very important for LIGO, because it would tell you that there will be this camp in the radiation. We know by theorems that no more than 29% of the mass can be radiated away. So at most, if you're going to radiate 5% of the mass at every single iteration, at every single encounter like this, you could do 5 of these. And if you catch one of the first one in the LIGO data stream, you can do a pretty good data analysis by trying to find the other 4 or the other ones that will come. But anyway, let me just give you a few notes and try to, again, make contact with some of the things some of you might be interested in looking into. At first sight, the prognosis is that while binary black hole orbits are underway, there is some qualitative and some quantitative answers, but more will have to come along the way to confirm where these results are there for sure, and especially the error bars. But as far as what we would really make an impact from the mathematical communities, can we have estimates of the expected growth given a given formulation to discern both among different formulations and to exploit this knowledge at the numerical level? That could make a huge impact today. Because so far we're kind of searching in the dark, trying to do the best we can, but it would be very helpful if some of this knowledge were to come our way. Something that is not known at all, and it's kind of surprising, is how you must deal in a problem with non-constant characteristics. Suppose you have this particular equation, u dot equal some function that depends on two coordinates, say, u comma x. You put a boundary at x equals 0, and this boundary is such that it's given by, or this function is such that boundary is a sign of y. As you go along the y lines, then this thing changes sign. And this problem mathematically is not understood at all as how to do the boundary problem in a well-posed manner. Already at the analytical level, we have a much tougher time at the numerical level. And unfortunately, we do have to deal with these kind of situations. Something neat is all this knowledge that we've gained as far as how to write the equations in an appropriate way is spilling out to our theory. And for instance, in the astrophysics community, the MHD equations that the astrophysicists use commonly are weakly hyperbolic, so they have the same kind of problems. So by going using the same kind of tricks that we've used at the GR level, you can fix, quote unquote, these equations, and all of a sudden, evolutions that were difficult before can be done routinely without any issue. And the last comment is that every simulation still required lots of resources and too long times. So further developments in numerical and computational techniques will have to show up. Let me now make contact with two problems, the black string problem and the bubble problem. These are, by going to lower dimensions, we can push things quite further ahead. So the main reason why I got involved in these things were I wanted to test all these techniques, which I said guarantee that if you know something at a continuum level, it can buy you a lot at a numerical level. I didn't want to use them in the 3+1 problem to begin with, because it actually, as you see, costs quite a bit of work to actually do these simulations. I wanted simpler problems where I can, just as you do, model problems where you can really test these ideas. So by talking about with people, especially initially with Bill Unruh and and Gary Horowitz, we find this black string problem, and then later on we're talking with Bob Myers, we found the bubble problem. So let me say a few things about that. So black strings are higher dimensional black hole analogs. In 5D, if you think of the black hole with maximum symmetries that you can write, well, you can have the hyperspherical black hole, just Schwarzschild, except that its surface is an S3, or you can have this one called the black string, which is surface S2 cross R, cross an extra dimension, which you can wrap around later on, and that's what we'll do. Bubbles, on the other hand, are topologically weird space-time in that there is a minimum radius that you can take. If you're an observer coming in from infinity, and you're measuring your aerial radius, that is a monotonically decreasing function, but at some point you reach a minimum that is non-zero, and then it starts growing again. So it's like a cigar-shaped topology. They are naturally of interest in some string theory flavors. There is one that is known and known analytically, this the Witten bubble. And we actually studied both systems numerically to try to understand what the future development would be. So let me go first with the black string case. So as I said, black strings are the higher dimensional analogs of black holes. They are very similar to just a regular black hole, the 3+1 one, in the such that it contains singularities. They are ruled out by null rays, but as I said, they are not unique, even if you assume spherical symmetry. So Gregory Laflamme, about 10 years ago, studied the obvious question is, well, we know black holes, at least at the linearized level, are stable in 3+1. What is the situation in higher dimensions? So they do so, and what they find is that if the length of the extra dimension is above some critical length, then it's not true that the modes of the perturbation that govern the perturbation are exponentially decaying. In fact, there is some that start exponentially growing. If you couple that result with the fact that for a given mass, if you fix the mass and you calculate the entropy of a black string, or an entropy of a hyperspherical black hole, this one is smaller than that one. So they conjecture the following. You have a black string, when things like look like cylinder, you kick it, it will wobble for a while, it will want to maximize its entropy, it's going to pinch off, form, say, two hyperspherical black holes that eventually will merge. But of course, you know that black holes cannot fission, they cannot break apart unless something nasty happened, and that nasty thing is a naked singularity. So this was a very interesting problem. So if this were true, it would generate naked singularity, violate cosmic censorship, and everything that you can imagine. But this was a conjecture. Later on, just a few years ago, Gary Horowitz and Kengo Maeda actually revisited the problem. They studied basically the Rice-Chaudhry equation with some simple and not so unreasonable assumptions, and then they can actually prove a theorem that says these high black strings cannot pinch off in finite affine time. So that is a theorem. You cannot argue with that, except, well, maybe the assumption, but the assumption is reasonable. But then there was a conjecture. If this thing is going to take an infinite affine time to pinch off, it can only do so by going sequentially through a sequence of stationary solutions, basically. So that would be the reason to take such a long time. And they argue that if that's going to be the case, it might as well just stay in one of these stationary solutions, and this it will never pinch off. So that's a conjecture, and it's something that you might hope to test numerically. Then there is quite a bit of work that have come out after it, trying to understand what really might happen. But this is all at a moment of time symmetry level, or assuming the condition of time symmetry in the problem and actually finding out solutions that are independent of time. But it's not clear whether those solutions are physical in the sense that can be realized in a physical situation or not. So what we did is we actually got in that problem and tried to do the evolution of a black string perturbed and see what happens to the future. So you just write the metric in that because there is symmetry in the angular directions, then it only depends on a few metric variables. It only depends on two directions, the radius and the extra coordinate, and you evolve it. Then you have to worry where you might need to evolve for extremely long times. Remember, Gary's conjecture is that this thing will just, along the way, might just stay in one of the stationary solutions, and you might want to make absolutely sure that there is no boundary that is influencing the evolution. And we use exactly the same trick that later on was used by France to compactify it, quote unquote, just push the boundary to infinity and use enough dissipations so that anything that gets out there will be killed. We monitor a bunch of geometrical quantities, basically invariants and things like that. The only thing I want to point out here is that resolution we use in the best resolved cases was about, if you think of a unit of length given by the mass of the string, the mass per unit length of the string was about m over 1600. Comparatively speaking, the best simulation that France can run nowadays is about m over 60 near the black hole. So there is an order of magnitude more in resolution here, and yet we do have problems. So let me show you some of the typical simulations you have. This is for a short string, one where you shouldn't expect an instability, and the other one is going to be for a long string, one that you would expect something interesting to happen. So this is the first case. So you kick the black string. Both the color and the distance from this axis is measuring the aerial radius, and this extra coordinate here is just along the extra dimension. So nothing really happened. All the finer structure, the higher order modes are radiated away a lot faster, and then this thing is decaying away to another string, uniform string. This is what happens when you make the string longer. Initially, it looks pretty much the same, but then you'll see. So this thing becomes quite skinny, and there is an elongation in that direction. You know that must happen because the area theorem is still are valid in higher dimensions. If you're shrinking in one direction, you better elongate in the other. Otherwise, you would be violating the theorem. So the string grows about 50% in this direction. And this, something that started off order 1, ended up being 0.3. And the code about this time crashes because of lack of resolution. So we have coordinate issues at the end of the day. We evaluate curvature invariants to see what in the world you can estimate from the end point of the simulation. Forget about this part. This is just to say that we measure apparent horizons, and there are good approximations to event horizon, but take my word for that. And so at later times, we evaluate this curvature invariant, and it's normalized in such a way that if you have a hyperspherical black hole, it should give you 6. If you have a black string, it should give you 1. So this is a region around the neck, and it's pretty darn close to 1. And this is a region about the bulge. It's not 6, but it's 5.5 or so. It's growing towards 6. So what this is telling you is, at least in this stage, we don't know whether it's close to the end stage or it's some intermediate stage, this would look like a hyperspherical black hole and joined by some thin black string with something going on in the middle. We also tried to test or try to see if we could get some information out of whether this might be bifurcated in infinite affine time or not. We did this side work with David Garfinkel and also Franz Pretorius, and what we calculated was actually the affine time around this region, and actually shooting to hell. It's going like 10 to the 22 at the end of the simulation. So it looks like this thing has shrunk enough, and there is quite a bit of affine time that has gone through. So this conjecture that the string might not pinch off in affine time, this is putting serious doubt of that, because we can actually go really, really far in affine time, and we are still not yet at the end of the final fate of this string. If you ask me, and you put a gun in my head, I can think of two possibilities that this thing is actually more pointed towards. One is a bifurcation in finite infinite affine time, that is certainly not ruled out by our simulations. And the other one is a cascade of unstable strings. Because if you actually measure this length, it actually is above the critical distance of a black string of mass, say, a tenth of this original one would have. So you now can probably, something that could happen is you'll have the same process going on in here. That will have to, the final answer of this story will have to wait till our new version of the code is finished. So that was an example of a simulation that actually could push the evolution of the system quite a bit, yet at the end of the day, it doesn't completely resolve the problem for problems that we do understand and we're trying to address at the moment. And the final one is the simplest possible problem. It's going to end up being a 1 plus 1 problem. But as you see, it's a problem that we understood from beginning to end. So this is this Kaluza Klein bubbles that I said. These were interesting problems for a while in the string theory community, because something that you don't have in higher dimension is the positivity of the mass. And so the question was there for a while whether you could actually write down solutions of the equation that had negative mass configurations. And this was one of the first ones. So Gary Horowitz, Pfister, and Brill have explicit time or initial data at the moment of time symmetry that do describe space-time that have negative masses, negative ADM masses. For quite a while, people wonder what would happen with the evolution of this system. So you have a negative mass configuration. What happens? Could something strange go on as you evolve the systems? So Corley and Jacobson in 94 actually took this particular one, which you'll show in the next slide, which you'll see in the next slide, and they analyzed what happens there with the bubble. So they locate the bubble, they calculate the acceleration, and they actually are able to write down a formula, a very simple formula that predicts what the acceleration is going to be. And there you can see that depending on the ADM mass, it can start with positive or negative acceleration. And they conjecture that if it's whatever it starts doing will continue doing so, because the argument is if it's going to change its behavior, it has to say it's expanding. If it's going to change its behavior to start collapsing back, it has to go through another moment of time symmetry. And the analysis was already done. The ADM mass is conserved, so the same argument should go through, and you shouldn't be able to stop the bubble again. There was a numerical effort in the year 2000 that actually tried to evolve this and gave very weird conclusions in that one of them was if you start with a negative mass configuration, you evolve in the future, all of a sudden as this bubble is going, a naked singularity shows up. So that is strange because you think of negative mass configurations not as collapsing things, but they're trying to expand things out. Why would a naked singularity show up in the middle of nowhere? And the problem of that simulation is it had all the problems that we had before. It had wrong equations, wrong boundary conditions, wrong constraint control, etc. So we actually went back to that problem. The initial data basically is something that you put these ansatz, you couple the problem to a gauge field. You solve the constraint equation, you only have to solve the Hamiltonian constraint. And then it turns out that to solve the answer to this is given by this expression, where this is the mass related to the ADM mass, this related to the period of the extra dimension at infinity, and this quantity here is related to this strength parameter of the gauge field. This is basically Corley and Jacobson result, except that they consider only the case of n equal 2, we generalize it to any given n. And then you have this expression for the acceleration of the bubble. So basically, if you set n equal 2, this term is not there. And just tells you that if m were to be negative, then the acceleration is always positive, and the bubble should start expanding. And if depending on the value of m, if m is positive, it can either start expanding or collapsing. So we actually got into this problem and tried to solve numerically what would happen. So the first thing was to retry the case that was done numerically before, which was the case for n equal 2, k equal 0. And we see that for all negative masses and all masses positive, but where the bubble should start expanding, just continue on expanding. And you can actually predict very well heuristically what the asymptotic behavior of this is going to be. And it pretty much coincides with the Witten bubble. So that put to rest this problem that the previous numerical simulation had. But once you have a code, you can start pushing in and try to see if you can get new results. So one was the following. See, I said that you could start with positive mass configurations where if you choose the mass appropriately, it will start collapsing. So now you can think of what is the effect of turning on this gauge field interaction might have. And what we see is that for small values of that for zero or some lower limit of this this gauge field interaction, things just basically describe a bubble that continue on collapsing, except at slower rates. For large enough values of the strength of the gauge field, the bubble just turns around and keeps and goes expanding. So the first message there is that the bubble can really turn around and completely change its behavior without really needing to go through another moment of time symmetry. That was the conjecture of Corley and Jacobson that turned out to be wrong. And I can also now say, well, what happens if I fine tune? And Piotr Bisson's talk earlier today, you saw all this rich critical behavior. So these are started to have the telltales of such a phenomena. You say, well, what happens if I keep tuning this parameter more and more? And it turns out that then you can see that you can make the bubble pretty much stop and seem to appear to approach a stationary solution. Then now you put the answers to the equation and say, well, there might be a stationary solution, and it turns out that you find a solution of the equations. And that solution is given by such expression, and you can actually solve for it. And now you have what we've thought of at the moment as a new stationary solution describing bubble spacetimes. So we showed this to Gary Horowitz. Fortunately, we were at Santa Barbara at that time. And asked him where this solution was known. He claimed it wasn't known, but the following day he came back laughing, saying not only was known, but I had it written in the paper last year. But he had it in a different space. So it turns out that if you grab this solution and make t go to iz, and z go to it, you reverse the role of z from spatial coordinate to time coordinate, and the same thing with the other one. And that describes a black string. It's a charged black string. And so, well, that was our hope of having a new solution. But then you say, well, there was this telltale observation or telltale signs that there was a critical phenomenon here. Let's see if we can actually study the perturbations around the stationary solution and see what we find. If indeed we're able to find a single unstable mode, then that is an indication that that's what we have, critical phenomena. So we actually do that for arbitrary dimensions in the spherical sector. And if you look at the spectrum of the operator that governs these perturbations, then you find out that you have a pulsation operator. It doesn't conform to the theorems that are written out there to understand what the spectrum would be, but basically use this. It's pretty much a Sturm-Liouville type problem that you can solve by working a bit. So we actually are able to find the unstable modes, and then we are able to play the game again. I mean, Gary played this game on us at doing a double analytical continuation to show our solution wasn't new. And so what we did is, well, suppose you have such a growing mode, and you do the double analytical continuation backwards. So now you go from bubble back to black strings. So this mode now becomes a harmonic mode in the z direction that is time independent. So now you find a perturbation of your black string that doesn't depend on time and can only exist if the black string is long enough, because these k are k's that you calculated at this level. Turns out that if you look at the inverse of that, it's related exactly, it's exactly equal to the black string instability length. So by studying the problem at the bubble level, you can come back and infer properties at the black string level. But moreover, something that you can do is that when you do this identification, because we started with a charged bubble, you end up with a charged black string. And something that you're able to see is that for as you add charge, the string, the unstable string, can be made shorter and shorter. So this is an example that as you add charge to your problem, the system becomes more and more unstable. So this is an example of a charged black string that becomes even more unstable as you add charge. And this is the opposite of what Gregory and Laflamme found for another family of charged black strings. So for a while, people have speculated or conjectured that you see in papers that whenever they had a charged black string, in the case of extremality, this string would go to a stable string. So here we have a case that in the case of extremality, things are going to get a lot worse. And this might have interesting repercussions to the Gubser-Mitra conjecture, if you know what that means. If you don't worry, because I'm not really sure. But I know what the gist of it is, and that basically says if you're thermodynamically stable, you should be classically stable. And we have an example here of a classical instability, and we have to find out what the counterpart of the thermodynamic quantities is. But it's some work in progress, and I have to learn a lot more about that. Something that was interesting is that you could write initial data to describe a negative mass configuration that starts contracting And by just playing around with this n parameter, which governed this, how steep the gauge field was, or this k, which governed how strong the interaction was, you can make a negative mass configuration of a bubble start collapsing. So that, I mean, it's interesting. You start with a negative mass configuration. You can, in principle, it looks like it starts collapsing. That indicates that there is an interesting scenario to violate cosmic censorship, because you'd have a negative mass configuration collapsing. And as far as we could, as far as we tried, and as much as we could with our code, no matter what we did, we couldn't violate cosmic censorship. This bubble, I mean, shrunk to arbitrarily small sizes and then bounces back and comes back with a vengeance. So this is an example of a bubble. This is the log of the area. So it starts at size 1. It goes about 2 orders of magnitude down in size, and then it shoots off. So this seems to be a very interesting problem to apply some of the techniques that that Fermos was talking about, maybe to understand this problem completely. Let me just say some final words. I mean, despite all the problems we have, and despite the 3 plus 1 problem not being solved, of the binary black hole problem not being completely solved, even though I show you quite a bit of success, quote unquote, by Franz Pretorius, numerical relativity, the promise of numerical relativity is still there, which is can provide an experimental setup to understand some lingering question and pose some new ones. And there are plenty of examples in the critical phenomena, in cosmology, and the bubble black string problem, as I showed today. There is the search for a robust generic implementation of Einstein's equations will benefit a lot, and I cannot say this strong enough, from extra input from the analytical community. Things like estimates that do include the lower order terms and that are as sharp as possible can really help us a lot. I know, I fully understand this is a problem dependent, but maybe the technique to understand or to obtain these estimates will give us some indications how to proceed to understand which formulation might be better or which way to treat the problem might be better. If there are estimates that include constraint growth that assume initially that the constraints are violated and have a way to estimate how these guys are going to behave, also will help us quite a bit. And we're talking with Igor DRA about this. Maybe he'll get interested. Constraint preserving boundary conditions or how to get around them. By that, I mean kind of this formulation that Friedrich and Nagy presented, where the issue of constraint preserving boundary condition is not there because they've actually worked really hard at the formulation level so that this issue is not there. Or how to do this constraint preserving boundary condition in a correct way. And by that, I mean not only do you want the problem to be well defined mathematically, but also at the physical level where you actually are able to put the boundary conditions you want so that you can put radiative type boundary conditions. There is no theory so far, and it's not clear how to proceed with non-constant characteristics, as I said before. So these are all problems that might be well within the numerical relativity community or the analytical community to solve for. The translation of any of these things to the numerics, although very hard, can be done, and we are doing so, and it actually plays a major role in a simulation. And the example of the bubble problem is one of them. There, by choosing an appropriate gauge and by choosing appropriate variables, you can prove at the very first step that if there are violations of the constraints, they are not going to grow faster than exponential, and it turned out to be crucial in our simulations. Of course, if you help us here, we're not going to ask you, though some people might think otherwise, I'm not going to ask you to translate this to the numerics. I'll do it myself. So I work on the numerics, the implementation, the resolution, and all the extra kind of worms that come with the problem. But at least I get a lot of help from you if you are able to do some headway here. So I guess I'll stop here. And I hope you did get an impression that even though we're not out of woods in any way, we are doing quite a bit of progress in a number of areas. You can help us a lot in a different number of areas. And at the end of the day, that problem of the bubble was there so that you see that, well, it can pay off handsomely if we have a good control on the equations. Thank you. Well, if you do it in the from the experience in the characteristic side, if you do it on characteristic surface or hyperboloidal surfaces that go null close to infinity, you don't need to do that because, as far as the outgoing wave is concerned, because the phase of the wave should be constant close to infinity, and we've seen in practice that this doesn't pose a problem. So by appropriately writing the equations, then there is this no issue. Even though the last point is infinitely far away from the next near neighbor, because the wave phases are constant, one doesn't lose resolution or doesn't lose accuracy there. So if you put these ansatz, so which is a perfectly good ansatz because you're assuming spheric symmetry in the angular sector, so it's an SO3 if you want in five dimensions, and you assume there is another Killing field and a U1 in the extra dimension, then these ansatz for the metric, if you plug this into the Hamiltonian constraint and you solve for that, then this function U has satisfied this property. Say you ignore the interaction with the gauge field. Say K is zero, so you only have these two terms. This one is related to the ADM mass simply by this relation. This R1 comes in there so as to avoid a conical singularity. So this quantity B has to satisfy a periodicity condition so that you do not end up with a conical singularity. So the only requirement for this bubble to exist is that U gets a zero value at a non-negative value of R. So by playing around with M and B, you can make pretty much whatever you want. So you can have a negative mass and you can put a negative mass there, and then B has to act accordingly so that U of R bubble is zero at a non-negative value of R.